Welcome to Belfast City Vineyard, where we are pursuing formation in the presence of Jesus, community gathered around him, and the impact he empowers us to bring in our families, city, and the world. The following message was given at one of our Sunday services. For more information, visit our website at belfastcityvineyard.com.
So if you haven't been with us, we have been journeying over the last decade, it seems, through the book of Luke. But it's been good, right? Yeah. So as we left, our journey through the life of Jesus in Luke's words last week, him and his disciples were in the home of Zacchaeus. Do you remember this? There was a radical life change that had just occurred over a meal, and Jesus was heard to declare, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost." And in our Bibles, as we've read that, there's a, then kind of a nice paragraph break and a headed title for the next story. And we see this kind of as a distinct gap. We see Jesus kind of sum up his encounter with Zacchaeus in this kind of nice little neat bow. It's almost like a thought for the day at the end of a program. And you know, roll credits, skip to ad break, grab the remote because we can't bear 2 minutes of something we're not in control of and we're not watching ads, grab your phone, whatever. Story done, program over. But that's not how Luke writes it. He's writing one continuing story. He didn't think we'll take a pause here, we'll add a heading for the next bit. Since chapter 9, if you can remember that far back, Jesus has been marching full steam ahead towards Jerusalem for the last time, towards the culmination of all that his life and his ministry and his teaching has been building to, towards his death. And as last week's passage started, Luke told us that they were passing through Jericho. They were on their way. If you know anything about your Middle Eastern geography, Jericho is then only about 15 miles from Jerusalem. They're only about a day away from their destination. They're getting close. And to understand today's passage, we have to try and get inside the head of the disciples a little bit. We've got to understand a little bit of their mindset. So as Jesus kind of declares this in Luke 19, he then rolls straight into, after, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save the lost." While they were listening to this, he went on to tell them a parable because he was near Jerusalem and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once. It's the same scene, it's the same people, they've just witnessed a complete life transformation. Even those who are in the bottom rung of the moral ladder, those who have sold out completely to the occupying Romans, they're being turned back. They're being declared children of Abraham, part of the family. They're being welcomed in. This just fueled the fire of what they thought was happening. They are marching on Jerusalem and it is on. It's go time. They're in this kind of generations-long mindset, as all the Jewish people would be, that a Messiah was going to come one day and overthrow the Roman occupiers, kick out the invaders, and restore the nation of Israel to its former glory. They're all expecting this earthly revolt that's going to establish a powerful kingdom that's going to last, and the disciples think they found their leader. Like, if this guy can turn tax collectors back into children of Abraham, it is on. It's go time. They've seen Jesus again and again demonstrate that he has the power. His teaching is more than a little confusing and unexpected in places, and they don't always fully grasp it, but he's got power. And he's said he's the one. He's the Messiah, expected from of old, and now it's time to go to Jerusalem. Don't fully get why he talks about dying a lot. We're going to just skip past that. It's on. We're going to Jerusalem. It's revolution time. The Romans are about to be kicked out. Let's have it. That's their mindset. They're pumped. And before they arrive in Jerusalem, Jesus tries again to help them see what's really going on, what's really at play here. And he lays out this parable or that we're going to look at today, or this story with another meaning behind it to try and help them see. He's trying to show them again that this kingdom, his kingdom is not of this world. It's not as they're expecting. It's not political or territorial. It's not Israel against the world. It's a calling back to who and what they were always meant to be. He's going to show them that his kingdom is both now and not yet. He's going to show them that it's going to cost them everything that they have. And we might not be expecting Jesus to, you know, to do something radical in our day that drives out the ruling political powers. Or maybe you are. That's fine. That's your opinion. But we all have our own ways of skewing and misunderstanding this life that Jesus invites us into. And so as we look at this today, we've got to get that mindset as we look at the parable. So if you have a Bible, turn with me to Luke 19. If you don't have a Bible at all, we'd love to give you one as a gift. We're going to read together. He said, Jesus, a man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then to return. So he called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 minas. It's about 4 months' worth of wages each. Put this money to work, he said, until I come back. But his subjects hated him and sent a delegation after him to say, we don't want this man to be our king. He was made king, however, and returned home. Then he sent for his servants to whom he had given the money in order to find out what they had gained with it. The first one came and said, sir, your mina has earned 10 more. Well done, my good servant, his master replied. Because you've been trustworthy in a very small matter, take charge of 10 cities. And the second came and said, sir, your mina has earned 5 more. His master answered, you take charge of 5 cities. Then another servant came and said, sir, here is your mina. I've kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you are a hard man. You take out what you did not put in and reap what you did not sow. His master replied, I will judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. You knew, did you, that I am a hard man, taking out what I did not put in and reaping what I did not sow? Why then didn't you put my money on deposit so that when I came back I could have collected it with interest? Then he said to those standing by, take his mina away from him and give it to the one who's 10 minas. Sir, they said, he already has 10. He replied, I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given, but as for the one who has nothing, even what they have will be taken away. But those enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me. Nice cheery end to the passage. Kind of confusing, right? So we got to look a little bit deep here at what Jesus is poking at. The first thing I want us to see this morning in this passage is that we don't want the king. For a lot of us, we don't want the king. The story opens with a man deciding he wants to be king. This nobleman, this ruler's man of influence and power, he decides, I want to be king. Seems kind of odd to us, but it makes perfect sense to the hearers. A little history lesson. Let's go history instead of geography. As the Roman Empire expanded from Rome, Caesar couldn't rule over all the lands that they were expanded into. And so what would happen is somebody of that land would come and present themselves before him, come with gifts and offerings and make a show of themselves and ask for the right to rule over that nation. And it would be granted, and in return they would keep their subjects in check and they would pay taxes to Rome and make sure that trade happened and all that good stuff. And so the listeners would be super familiar with this. Herod the Great, BC 40, he travels to Rome, he meets with Mark Antony, he is granted the rule of Judea, which is where this takes place. As king, he's granted that. About 30 years later, as he passes on, his son, or one of his sons, Herod Archelaus of 4 BC, decides he wants to do the same. And he travels to the now Caesar Augustus. Except this time, the people don't really like him. Not that they really liked his dad, but they kind of decide, we really don't like this guy. And so they did this very thing. They sent a delegation after him to say, we don't want this guy to be our king. And actually Caesar kind of mocks him. He sends him back with a little bit of power, but not called king. He calls him an entrarch. And he has to earn the right to be king. It's like he's got training wheels on. And he never does. It doesn't work out so well for him. But this was live. This had only happened like 4 or 5 years ago. So this makes perfect sense to the listeners of the day. And the heat here, as Jesus tells this parable or tells this story and says the delegation hated this man, it's really strong. It seems too strong. It's not a great translation. It's not directed per se at this noble man. They're not saying we hate him. We hate, you know, we hate what he wears and then we hate what he says and we don't like this guy. They hate the idea of being ruled over. They hate the idea of being subjugated to someone else's power. They're objecting to this man not as an individual, but in this position of lordship and rulership over him. And Jesus is straight away beginning to poke at the mindset of the Jewish elite of the day that has kind of permeated the culture over the last generations. They had the Old Testament or the Torah. They had heard the prophets again and again and again throughout countless generations call them back to living as God had instructed them to do, living under his rule and reign, being faithful to their king. But they didn't want that. They wanted the privileges of being God's chosen people. They wanted a promised Messiah to make the nation great again. They wanted the benefits, but they did not want to come under Yahweh's rule and reign. They did not want to live out the life that he called them to. They wanted to be like all the other nations around them, not set apart by the one true God. And that's the generational cycle that they've been stuck in. And 2,000 years later, we've moved about zero steps forward. Many of us have no problem at all with Jesus per se. We like the idea. We like some of his teachings. We think that he was an interesting character. We simply don't like the idea of surrendering control of our lives to anyone or anything. We want the life that the Bible promises, a life of purpose and meaning, of unconditional love, of secured identity, of community and significance. But we don't want the God who offers it. This is the post-Christian culture that we live in right now. There's a pastor slash cultural genius in Australia called Mark Sayers, and he writes this: post-Christianity is ultimately the project of the West to move beyond Christianity while feasting upon its fruit. Thus, it constantly offers us options and off-ramps in which we seemingly have what we enjoy about faith, but without the sacrifices and commitments. It does not demand that we become apostates, rather that we reshape our faith to suit the contours of the day, and in the process offers us the promises of tangible freedoms and pleasures for doing so. It does not challenge our faith head on in a kind of apologetics debate. Rather, it uses soft power, offering a continual background hum of options and incentives which eat away at our commitments. We are offered the mirage that we can have community without commitment, faith without discipleship, the kingdom without the king. To steal and misquote Eliot's line, our faith doesn't disappear with a bang, but with a whimper. We want the kingdom without the king. We want to know, we want to be known and loved and accepted in community without vulnerability, without risk, without giving of ourselves to serve others, and without committing to one another in case of a better option arises. We want to do something of meaning and purpose and significance with our lives, but we want our buffers in our bank accounts and in our schedules. We want to be significant, but we also want to be comfortable and avoid pain and suffering at all costs. We want to know Jesus deeply and intimately, but we also want to binge watch Netflix 5 hours a night. We want the kingdom without the king. We want the benefits without the cost. We want a world that is shaped with biblical ethics and a moral and just society without having to follow biblical ethics and be moral and be just. This is our culture. This is what we swim in, day out, inside and outside of the church, inside and outside of our own hearts, if we're honest. And it's not dissimilar to the group that Jesus is speaking to. They wanted the kingdom, but they didn't want the king. And Jesus is poking straight at that. He's coming straight at it. This thing that you think we're about to do in Jerusalem, it's not what you think. This thing that we're building towards, it's not what's in your heads. This kingdom that I am bringing is not what you've longed for. And I'm not going to labor on it, but the end of this story, as you've seen, does not go well for those who oppose the king. There will be an end. We will all stand at some point before Jesus, and he will not be asking, did you believe in me? Did you show up in church? Did you know enough about me? It will be, did you follow me? Did you come under my rule and reign? Did you partner with me to serve and to bless and to bring my kingdom to bear? Did you live the life of purpose I made you for? Did you know me as king, or did you simply want my kingdom? It's a question we got to ask ourselves today. Are we living for the kingdom and not the king? Or do we want the king? Secondly, there are things that God won't do. Not in a meatloaf kind of style, but there are things that God won't do. That just took a minute there, some of you. So the nobleman, he leaves his land and he leaves his wealth, takes a sip of his water, and travels for some time to become king. And in his absence, he empowers these 10 servants to carry on his business. He isn't expecting maintaining. He doesn't say, right, chaps, I'm away. Hold the fort. Don't touch any of my stuff. Don't pause my series links. Don't burn the house down. Keep her going. I'll be back. Just keep it steady. It's not what he says. He says, put my money to work or do my business. It's stronger than that. In the original language, it's way more forceful. He's saying, make me a profit. Make me a profit. F-I-T. Make me money. Not P-H-E-T. Make me profit. Expand this thing. Make it bigger and better. Cause my interests to increase. He's not going to be present to do the work, but he's expecting his business interests to flourish as though he were personally involved. He's expecting growth. He's expecting return as he goes. Now, parables aren't direct correlations. Don't panic. We don't take from this that God is somehow absent, that he's gone, that he's disinterested, that he's no longer at work in the world. The point that Jesus is trying to make, I believe, is the very heart of the Bible story from beginning to end, from Genesis to Revelation, from creation through till the end of eternity, which never ends. It's the same story. That first and foremost, we were made for union with God. We were made to be in relationship with him, to be known by him, to be intimately connected to him. But it wasn't just for that. He didn't just make a people so that we could kind of sit in an endless hug. It's not what he did. We were empowered as stewards of this earth to participate in God's creative plans. We were invited into partnership with him. Genesis 1:27. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, or cause it to flourish. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. He empowered humanity with authority to rule and reign alongside him. Genesis 9, it continues, as Noah comes out of the ark, the first thing he says is he reestablishes that covenant and he says, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. I'm giving you responsibility. I'm calling you to do this mission of filling the earth with my rule and my reign. Genesis 12, again, speaking to Abraham, I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who curse you and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth for all time will be blessed through you. It's a big calling on a man's life. We were always made to be in partnership with God. We could go on and on. That's an entirely different sermon. But God's plan for this world before and after the fall always included us as empowered stewards of this earth, as friends with him, given authority to partner in his plans and purposes. And even when sin gets so bad that God wants to wipe the slate clean with Noah and his family, he still empowers them with the same mandate, the same calling to extend his rule and his reign. It still sits today. We, each one of us, are made with a purpose, planned by him, gifted like him, invited into his mission of causing this earth and all who inhabit it to flourish. God will not do that on his own. I'm not saying he can't. He absolutely could, but he will not do that on his own. He entrusted it to us. He placed Adam and Eve in a perfect garden, fully under his rule and reign, and he said, multiply this throughout generations across the whole earth. God could have made the whole earth like Eden. He didn't. He made a garden. He said, this is the starting point. You now have power. You have authority. Be my stewards. Cause this to replicate throughout the world. Use the power that I've given you. Use the authority that I've given you to extend what I've done here. And that's always been the purpose of his people. This is the great mission of his church. This is what we're called to. Not to simply get people into heaven when they die, but to extend the rule and the reign of God to every corner of this earth. To invite everyone we encounter into an intimate, life-giving relationship with their Creator. To, in thousands of small and creative ways, cause this earth to flourish. I don't know what story you've grown up with. I grew up with the story of the church that God was asking us to batten down the hatches, maintain as best we can this sinking ship called the church, in the midst of a wicked and evil culture that's overrunning it, just hold fire until we return, you know, seven old ladies in their King James Bibles, and that'll be about it, and then he'll come back. We need more old ladies with King James Bibles. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not a compelling story. That's about as compelling as a kick in the teeth, right? That's not what God asked his church to do. We're not supposed to be holding down the hatches, maintaining and hoping he comes back soon. This nobleman empowers them to do business. Take my money and make me a profit. And he says the same to us. He's empowered us to be his co-conspirators of righteousness and justice, to bless this world, to call it back to the way it was supposed to be, to seek the prosperity and the blessing of the city around us, to cause our jobs and our workplaces to thrive with kingdom wisdom and solutions, to be hubs of welcome and hospitality in our neighborhoods and in our communities, to create art that challenges and inspires and restores hope, to serve the poor and to fight for justice, to model out a life of joy that is lived with margins and with rest, to demonstrate sacrificial, self-giving marriage in a world that is utterly obsessed with consumer sex. To take the passions and the gifts placed in each one of us and use them for the blessings of the world around us. That's what we're called to. God will not do this. God will not do this. He did not ask us to show up on Sunday mornings, sing some hymns, behave, and then that would empower him to change the world. That was never the plan. You were the plan. I was the plan. I don't know if I can say this any more forcefully. Like, our oceans will not clean themselves. Our poor will not feed themselves. The economy that we want will not find its own sane and just system. Our excluded and unseen and forgotten peoples will not welcome themselves back in. God's intervention plan is you. That's what we're called to. Not pray a prayer and wait till we die. Not put on a good show on a Sunday morning. There's no danger of that here. We are called to live out the life of the kingdom. We are empowered with power and authority to do that. More than that, do you know you are trusted? You are trusted. God in heaven looks down with his heart broken in this world and he says, I trust you to work it out. Trust you. You're trusted. And we went to a birthday party yesterday morning. Anybody been to that water park that's up in Carrie Duff in the reservoir? Anybody been there? It's like this giant, like, inflatable obstacle course. I know, right? It's awesome. And so obviously one of us had to go in to look after the kids. So I volunteered. Let me say this. There is no dignity in a wetsuit. You spend like half an hour and ruin all your muscles getting it on, and then you still got the zipper to wrestle with, and you got to like dislocate your shoulder to get that zipper up. It just doesn't happen, right? You been there? So anyway, finally getting there, life jackets on, safety briefing. I've got two kids. I've got a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old. They've been pumped about this for weeks. We're standing on the edge. They're like, we're going to blow the whistle, and then you jump in, and I'm going, I thought it would be a lot more structured. We've got like four disinterested, you know, young adults with our supposedly lifeguards at various points, kind of like sitting up there, and they're going to blow a whistle, and like 50 of us are just going to jump into a reservoir and swim for it. Like, oh, help. I'm like, I can't play man-to-man defense here. I've got two. Caleb, you're 10, you're a man, you're on your own. For about the first few minutes, I really tried to like watch them both and hold them both, and I'm like, I've got this. And like, I had to kind of go, Caleb, I really trust you. I trust you. Be safe. Have at it. He had a life jacket on. But I had to trust him. And he had the best day. We had so much fun. But he knew the parameters. He knew he couldn't swim under the stuff. He knew that if he was in trouble, he could shout to the lifeguards. He knew that I was watching as best I could. But he was also trusted to go. Because Izzy wanted, she's younger, she wanted to do some of the safer stuff. And he's like, when are we going to jump off the giant thing? And I'm like, probably never. But she was never getting there. So I was like, I trust you. Go. You know your limits. Pick your own path through this thing. Have fun. Our Father in heaven trusts you. He trusts you. Your job is not to show up here on a Sunday morning and do exactly what we tell you. Because I don't think we ever tell you anyway. Your job is to be in deep, intimate connection with your Father in heaven. To take the gifts and the passions that he's placed in your heart. And to call this world back into flourishing under his rule and reign. You're trusted. You're trusted beyond measure. You were not made to follow religious rules. You were made to partner with the creator of the universe. Some of you, you need to hear that again this morning. You are trusted. Even though you've messed that trust up, guess what? He still trusts you. He still is empowering you with authority to work in his kingdom. The Bible is pretty clear. We're empowered stewards. We're given authority with God to rule and to reign over his earth. It's pretty clear that we, as the church, as followers of Jesus, have been tasked with bringing life to all aspects of the world around us. And the Bible is also pretty clear that God expects a return on the authority and the power that he's entrusted to us. We don't like this bit so much. He expects a return. The master returns in the story now as king and demands an account. He wants to know what's been done with what he invested. He wants to know what they've done with his money. He wants to check in, see what's been happening. And to the one who's been faithful with the 10, much more is given, more authority, more at right to rule and reign. Do you notice that it's not you made a bunch of money for me, have some more money and make me more? Did you notice that? It's you made me, you know, 10 times what? So now I'm going to put you in rulership over 10 cities? That's intentional by Jesus. It's not make me some money, I'll give you more money. It's if you show you're faithful with the gifts and the passions that you have, I will invite you into rulership with me, into partnership with me. There's more power, there's more authority. I will trust you with more. Not just more of the same, but bigger and better. As we're faithful with the little that God has given us, do not be surprised if he increases your authority and your power. Do not be surprised if you find yourself in unlikely rooms going, how in the world did I get here? And why am I here? And do they know who I am? Did they get the invite wrong? Do not be surprised. As you're faithful with the little that God gives you, he will give you more. He will give you more. And Luke is super intentional here. He links this idea of making a profit or making a return for the master in the story. He links it with the lives that we lead as followers of Jesus and the words that he uses. The word in verse 18, to earn or to make, how much have you made for me? It's the same word that's translated everywhere else or lots of other places as to bear fruit or to bring forth fruit. And we know that language from the Bible as to be a language of discipleship, of how in intimacy with Jesus we bring forth good fruit in the world. We bring forth his kingdom rule and reign in our lives. Things like love and joy and peace and patience, kindness and goodness. Those are the fruits that well up in us. And so Luke is saying here, this is about living in such a way that the very life that is my precious investment that I've given to you brings forth good fruit. That bears much fruit. I love it when we hear our kids having fun. So good. So good. So good. You're trusted. You're trusted with God's most precious investment, which is your life. He thought you into being. He thought you were a good idea. He thought that we needed you in this city at this time for his purpose. And he imparted to you something that he expects to see a return on. That isn't a fear thing. That isn't a guilt thing. That's an invitation thing into partnership. Will you simply be faithful with what he's placed in you? Your wisdom, your gifts, your intelligence, your passion, whatever it is that you have, will you be faithful with it to see his kingdom come to pass? Are we living for the kingdom without fidelity to the king? It costs. This thing costs. Jesus says elsewhere, it costs that you'll seek first my kingdom, that you'll lay everything else down for the sake of what I want to do in you and through you, but the rewards are great as he offers an increase of his presence and an increase in authority and rule with him. Nope. Skip those out. We don't want the king. There are things that God won't do that he calls and he leaves us to do. And then finally here we see that the king can be known. The king can be known. So we get the first servant that he calls back and he's done a stellar job. We've got 10, got like a 10,000, whatever that percentage is, increase. My maths is off today. And then we get the second. He multiplies it 5 times. That's the safer maths equation. And then we get the third one. The third servant's called in and he panics. He's panicked. He's heard of this reputation of this master being hard and being unfair and unjust. It might be a viable excuse. Maybe he did think he was that way. Or maybe he was simply being lazy. We don't know. But either way, on his return, the new king is not best pleased. He's not best pleased. There's uncertainty here with many of the theologians as to what happens to this wicked servant. And we don't have time to go into all the nuances of that this morning. But what I want us to see is simply this. This man was one of the master's servants. He's not part of that first group that we saw that hated the king, that opposed the king, that didn't want the king to rule over them. He's not in that group. He's one of the 10 chosen servants. He's on the inside. He's part of the club. He's been invested in. He's been trusted. He's been empowered. He's one of the master's known people. And yet he fully misunderstands the master's character and the master's heart. He doesn't get it. He misses it completely. Darrell Bock, theologian, puts it this way. The servant may have been caught on the horns of a dilemma. If I earn money, you take it. If I lose it, you'll hold me responsible. He's so paralyzed by fear that he could not act. Interestingly, the king's response to the first two servants has already proven this fear false. The third servant does not know the king. He doesn't know the king's heart. He thinks he's in a zero-sum game. He's terrified about getting it wrong. He's pretty sure that there's no point in getting it right. It's not going to bear any fruit for him anyway. Let's just hide it. Let's just log it down. Let's just put it, wrap it up in a bit of cloth and wait till he comes back. I grew up for a long time thinking the best I could ever get to with God was neutral. Like if I try really, really hard and read a lot of Bible and pray hard, maybe by the time I'm gray, which I'm getting there now, like I won't sin anymore or something like that. Maybe God might not be mad at me for a day if I try really hard. The best I can get to is neutral. This is what this servant's idea of the master is. There's no good is going to come of this for me. There's a potential for harm, potential for judgment. I'm just going to stick it in the ground. I'm going to bury it, whatever. I find this really quite disconcerting. I get that the culture around us doesn't want the king, doesn't want Jesus. But Luke makes it really clear here that it's possible to be on the inside, in inverted commas, and still miss the heart and the character of Jesus. It's possible to sit here week in, week out, and still think that God is ruthless and vindictive, looking for any excuse to strike you down. It is possible to be a follower of Jesus and not really follow him. It's possible to think that we are aligning our lives as a Christian and yet missing his heart completely, living in the fear of getting it wrong, living in the fear of messing up, living expecting God to be mad at us every day, hoping for neutral at best. You are loved. Your position with him is secure. You're invited into partnership with the creator of the universe, in which he could do anything he wants, and he stays his hand and instead empowers you and entrusts you to issue life and hope and peace and joy on his behalf. He is not looking to strike you down. He is not waiting for you to mess up so he can go like, I knew you were a bad bet. He loves you. He trusts you. He is inviting you into union with him and partnership with him. Do you know Jesus? Do you simply know enough about him to be fearful or wary of him, or do you actually know him? Have you encountered his tender mercy? Parables are not direct correlations. They're stories that make a point, that challenge and encourage us towards the heart of our Father in heaven. There's plenty more here we could spend hours wrestling over, but my question is really simple. And I think Luke's question is really simple. Do you know him? Do you know his heart? Do you know that his deep desire is that you would follow him so that this world around you would be blessed by the way you live and the life that he transforms in you? Are you simply trying to get a ticket stamped for heaven, trying really hard not to mess up today? Or are you with reckless abandon seeing and trying and experimenting what ways God's kingdom might break out if you follow the things he's placed in you? This world does not need any more religion. It does not need any more of us performing and battening down the hatches. It needs us living out the power and the authority that's been entrusted to us.
Thanks for listening to this message. For all the latest information about what's happening in the life of our church, or if you have any questions or comments, head over to BelfastCityVineyard.com.